This is Audible.
Sounds True presents You're It, on Hiding, Seeking, and Being Found, an anthology of selected archival recordings by stand-up philosopher Alan Watts. We begin our program with Session 1 on Spiritual Authority with Alan Watts.
I may take the liberty of beginning by saying something about myself and my role in talking to you about philosophical matters, because I want it to be understood perfectly clearly that I am not a guru. In other words, I talk about what we call these things, and that comprises a multitude of interests concerning Oriental philosophy, psychotherapy, religion, mysticism, etc. I talk about these things because I'm interested in them and because I enjoy talking about them. And every sensible person makes his living by doing what he enjoys doing. And that explains me. Now, in saying, therefore, that I am not a guru, that means also that I'm not trying to help you or improve you. I accept you as you are. I am not out, therefore, to save the world. Of course, when a stream, a bubbling spring, flows out from the mountains, it's doing its thing. And if a thirsty traveler helps himself, well, that's fine. When a bird sings, it doesn't sing for the advancement of music. But if somebody stops to listen and is delighted, that's fine. And so I talk in the same spirit. I don't have a group of followers. I'm not trying to make disciples. Because I work on the principle of a physician rather than a clergyman. A physician is always trying to get rid of his patients and send them away healthy to stand on their own feet. Whereas a clergyman is trying to get them as members of a religious organization so that they will continue to pay their pledges, pay off the mortgage on an expensive building, and generally belong to the church, boost its membership, and thereby prove by sheer weight of numbers the veracity of its tenets. And my objective is really to get rid of you so that you won't need me or any other teacher. I'm afraid some of my colleagues would not approve of that attitude, because it is widely believed and said that in order to advance in the spiritual life, whatever that is, it is essential that you have a guru and that you accord to that guru perfect obedience. And so I'm often asked the question, is it really necessary to have a guru? I can answer that only by saying, yes, it is necessary if you think so. In the same spirit as it is said that anybody who goes to a psychiatrist ought to have his head examined. Of course, there is more in that saying than meets the ear. Because if you really are sincerely concerned with yourself and are in such confusion that you feel you have to go to a psychiatrist to talk over your state, then of course you need to go. Likewise, if you are in need of someone to tell you what to do to practice meditation or to attain a state of liberation, nirvana, moksha, or whatever it may be called, and you feel that necessity very strongly, then you must do it, because, as the poet William Blake said, the fool who persists in his folly will become wise. However, I do want to point this out. What is the source of a guru's authority? He can tell you that he can speak from experience, that he has experienced states of consciousness which have made him profoundly blissful, or understanding, or compassionate, or whatever it may be. And you have his word for it. And you have the word of other people who likewise agree with him. But each one of them, and you in turn, agree with him out of your own opinion and by your own judgment. And so it is you that are the source of the teacher's authority. And that is true whether he speaks as an individual or whether he speaks as the representative of a tradition or a church. You may say that you take the Bible as your authority, or the Roman Catholic Church. And the Roman Catholic following very often says that the individual mystical experience is not to be trusted because of its liability to be interpreted in a whimsical and purely personal way, and that it has to be guarded against excesses by the substantial and objective traditions of the Church. But those traditions are held to be substantial and objective only because those who follow believe it to be so. They say so. And if you follow it, you say so. So the question comes back to you. Why do you believe? Why do you form this opinion? Upon what basis does all this rest? Well, of course, almost everybody is looking for help. Unless, when I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. But there is this feeling of a certain helplessness, of being alone and somewhat confused in an unpredictable, wayward, external world of happenings. And this world of happenings includes an enormous amount of suffering, tragedy, and we wonder why we're here, how we got here, and in short, what to do about the capital P problem of capital L life, to which should be added death, because it seems to be certain that we're all going to die, and that death may be a painful process. That those we love are going to die, and so what about it? Is there any way in which we can become masters of the situation? Well, there are all sorts of ways of trying to escape from the human predicament of being a lonely, isolated consciousness in the midst of this enormous and wayward not-self. We can, of course, try to beat the game on a material basis by becoming very wealthy or very powerful. We may resort to all kinds of technology to get rid of our sufferings, hunger, pain, sickness, and so forth. But it will be noticed that as we succeed in these enterprises, we are not satisfied. In other words, if you feel at this moment that an increase in income would solve your problems, and you got an increase in income, this would give you a pleasant feeling for a few weeks. But then, as you well know, if that's ever happened to you, the feeling wears off. And you may stop worrying about paying your debts and start worrying about whether you will get sick. There is always something to worry about. And if you are very rich indeed, you've still got the anxiety about sickness and death, and also anxieties about revolution and about whether the Internal Revenue Service will take it all away from you or catch you for cheating on your taxes or put you in prison for no good reason. Now, there is always this worry. And so you realize that the problem of life does not really consist in your external circumstances, because you worry whatever they are. The problem consists in rather in what you call your mind. Could you, by some method, control your mind so that you won't worry? And how on earth would you do that? Well, there are those people who tell you that the best answer is to think positive thoughts, to be peaceful, to breathe slowly and hum gently, and get yourself into a peaceful state of mind by repeating affirmations such as all is light, all is God, all is good, or whatever it may be. But unfortunately, it doesn't always work, because you have a nagging suspicion in the back of your mind that you're simply hypnotizing yourself and whistling in the dark. What the Germans call a Hintergedanke, which is a thought concealed way, way back behind your intellect, but it has a gnawing persistence. What if? And so you realize that this matter of controlling the mind is no superficial undertaking, because although you may be able to smooth the ruffles of your consciousness, there is beneath that a vast area of unconsciousness which erupts as unpredictably as events in the external world. And so you consider seriously the possibilities of psychoanalysis, to go down and get into those depths and see if oil can be put on those troubled waters. And then, of course, you get into the guru business. You have to go to someone against whose mirror you can reflect those aspects of yourself of which you are not directly aware. So as the process goes on, you find there is something awkward about all this. And this awkwardness can be expressed in many different ways. One of them is this: how on earth are you to get at yourself to do something about yourself? Because it's a project not unlike trying to pierce the point of the pin with the point of the same pin. In other words, if you feel that you could do with some sort of psychological or spiritual improvement, obviously you are the character who's going to have to bring this about. But if you are the one who needs to be improved, how are you going to accomplish the improvement? You're in the predicament of trying to lift yourself up off the floor by pulling at your own bootstraps. And as you all know, that cannot be done. And if you attempt to do so, you're likely to land with a bang on your fanny and be lower down than you were in the first place. So that problem continually arises, and it has arisen historically in all the great religious traditions. We find it in Christianity, in the debate between St. Augustine and Pelagius. And Pelagius said that if God had given us a commandment to love him and to love our neighbors, he would not have done so unless we could obey it. St. Augustine countered and said, yes, but the commandment was not given in order for it to be obeyed. God never expected that it would be obeyed, because we were incapable of loving anyone but ourselves. The commandment was therefore given to convince us of our sinfulness, from which we could be rescued only by divine grace, that is to say, by the infusion of our souls with a power beyond them. And that was more or less the doctrine for which the Church settled. The puzzle has always been, therefore, how to get grace. Because grace is apparently freely offered to all, but some people seem to get it and some don't. With some the medicine takes, and with others it doesn't. Why? Well, apparently you have the power to resist grace, but if you do, you also have the power not to resist it. We would like, therefore, to know how not to resist it and to be open. And there you see we are back at exactly the same problem with which we began. It's like saying you must relax. Damn you. Let go. Give in. And I know I ought to give in. I know I ought to let go and abandon my will to the divine will. But as St. Paul put it so well, to will is present with me. But how to do that which is good, I find not. For the good that I would, I do not, and the evil that I would not, that I do. In other words, we all come down to a basis in ourselves, which we will call, so first of all, since we are in a Jewish temple, the Yetzer Hara, or the wayward spirit, which God is supposed to have put into the soul of Adam, or in my translation, our element of irreducible rascality, where we are all basically scamps. And if you haven't found that, you're very unconscious. I know all sorts of people who are full of outward love, but of course it always turns up that they need money. And when it comes to money, the virtue flies out of the window. So we do have that element in ourselves, we know it very well. And the question is, therefore, once again, how can it be transformed? But if the transformer is the one who is afflicted, who transforms the transformer? It's the old problem of who guards the guards, who polices the policeman, who governs the government. And it seems perfectly insoluble for that reason alone, that it is a vicious circle. There's a great deal of talk about two selves, the lower self or ego, the higher self, called the spirit or the Atman, and the duty of the Atman seems to be to transform the wretched little ego. Well, sometimes it does, but a lot of times it doesn't. So we ask, why doesn't so-and-so's Atman succeed in getting through? Is his ego too strong? If so, who will weaken it? Is his Atman too weak? And if so, why? For surely aren't all Atmans the same? The puzzle remains. So let's take a look at what we're trying to accomplish. We're trying to get better. We are out after that type of experience which we will call the positive, the good, the light, the living. And to get away from the negative, the evil, the dark, and the dead. Unfortunately, however, human experience, human consciousness, knows by contrast. We are equipped with a nervous system where the neurons either fire or don't fire. All that we are aware of is made up of an extremely complicated arrangement of yes and no. And by recording on magnetic tape impulses, there are areas where there is a pulse and there are areas where there is not a pulse. And by so doing, we can tape almost any form of human experience. In other words, we can put colored television on a tape, so that it is all reduced to a matter of yes and no. And you will understand, of course, that that is the philosophy of the Chinese Book of Changes, the I Ching, which represents all the situations of life in terms of combinations of the yang, or positive principle, and the yin, or the negative principle. Interestingly enough, a Latin translation of the I Ching was read by the philosopher Leibniz. And from this he invented binary arithmetic, wherein all numbers can be represented by 0 and 1. And that is the number system used by the digital computer, which lies behind all our electronic ingenuity. This great extension of the nervous system, which is based on the same principle. But you see what we are trying to do. We are trying to have yang without yin. We are trying to arrange a life game in which there is winning without losing. Now, how can you arrange such a state of affairs? A game in which everybody wins would end up, as W.S. Gilbert put it, when everybody is somebody, then no one's anybody. If we are all equally happy, it is impossible to know that we are happy, because a certain flatness comes over everything. If we lifted up all valleys and lowered all mountains, we should have the sort of thing they are attempting to do with bulldozers in the Hollywood Hills, to the destruction of the ecology, in ghastly fulfillment of the biblical prophecy that every mountain, every valley should be exalted, and every mountain laid low, and the rough places made plain. And I'm sorry to say it was Isaiah to whom this temple is dedicated, who made that remark. But the same Isaiah also said something that at least Christians do not often quote, which is this following sentence: I am the Lord, and there is none else. I form the light and create the darkness. I make peace and I create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. In spite of which, everybody is busy trying to be good, not realizing that we would not recognize saints unless there were sinners, or sages unless there were fools. And there is no way out of that dilemma. That is why Buddhism represents existence in terms of a wheel called the Pava Chakra, the wheel of becoming, of birth and death. And on the top of that wheel, there are Deva people, whom we would call angels. And at the bottom of the wheel, there are Naraka, or tormented people, in purgatory. And you go round and round, now this way, now that way. It's really like a squirrel cage, where you're running and running and running to get to the top. And yet, you have to run faster and faster to stay where you are. And that's why there is always the sense of the more you succeed in any scale of either worldly or spiritual progress, the more you have the haunting feeling that you're still in the same place. So you think, now there must be some way out of that. Perhaps there's something ambitious and proud and wrong in aspiring to be enlightened or compassionate. Perhaps there's a great dose of spiritual pride in that, that I, by my efforts, could make myself into a Buddha or a saint. And therefore, perhaps the thing to do is to try to eliminate all desire. Not only the desire for worldly success, but likewise the desire for spiritual success. For the Buddha proposed that desire was the root of suffering, and therefore suggested to his hearers that if they eliminated desire or clinging, they might cease from suffering. But you must realize that the so-called teachings of the Buddha are not doctrines in the sense that the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims have doctrines. They are proposals. They are the opening steps in a dialogue. And if you go away and try not to desire in any way, you will very quickly discover that you are desiring not to desire. And so we very rapidly come to a situation where you discover that with regard to your own transformation, everything you try to do about it doesn't work. It may have some sort of temporary success to make you feel better, but again and again you come back to the same old gnawing problem. And that is why people interested in spiritual things tend to move from one sect to another, from one teacher to another, always hoping that they will meet one who has the answer. Of course, then, there are many teachers who say, indeed, there is nothing you can do. And therefore, you have to practice non-doing, as the Taoists call it, wu-wei, non-striving. But then you find in turn that it's extraordinarily difficult not to strive. It's like trying not to think of a green elephant. And immediately you think of it. And so you come to the dismal conclusion that you can neither achieve what you want to achieve, that is to say, liberation from the alternation of the opposites by striving, nor can you achieve it by not striving. And thereby you have learned that you cannot concentrate on purpose. It's like trying to be unself-conscious on purpose, or to be genuine on purpose, or to love on purpose. When you say, I ought to love, well, that puts you in a double bind. When we say of a person, well, he's trained himself to be deliberately unself-conscious, or he has very disciplined spontaneity. But what we were looking for was somebody whose spontaneity was genuine, so that the scaffolding didn't show. And we believe that there are such people, like children, but they don't know how interesting they are. And when they find out, they become brats. Imagine for a moment that it was your privilege to have a brief interview with God, in the course of which you were allowed to ask one question. What would you ask? Now, you would have to think this over very carefully, because this golden opportunity would come to you only once, and you would have to be most careful that you didn't ask a silly question. Well, you might try God out with a Zen Buddhist koan, such as, beyond the positive and the negative, what is reality? And the Lord would turn to you and say, my dear child, your question has no meaning. And you wouldn't have the opportunity to think up a meaningful one and come back. So perhaps you should have asked, what question should I ask? And the Lord would say to you, why do you want a question? See, it seems you do want one, don't you? Because you feel that something is wrong if you don't have a problem. Well, you've got one. That is, the insoluble problem of trying to win without losing. Now, as long as you can keep that problem, you'll be busy. Only, however, until you see that it can't be solved. But there are all sorts of ways of presenting that problem in such a way that you cannot see that it's meaningless. And the better gurus are very clever at bringing these ways out. You may see, for example, if you are invited to practice intense concentration, that after a while you find yourself thinking about concentrating, and therefore that your concentration is somewhat divided. Or he may ask you, why are you concentrating? What is your motivation for this activity? And you find out that it's your element of irreducible rascality. So, however, the teacher, once he's seen that we've mastered that lesson, has something still more ingenious. He says, now, you've actually made progress. Because finding out that you could not really concentrate was valuable because it began to prick the illusion of your ego. But you've only got your foot in at the door. Beyond this are many, many higher things to be learned, and you must redouble your efforts. And so, of course, you apply yourself all the more, again and again, on all sorts of tricks that these old gentlemen can come out with. And you will keep at it just as long as he can make you fall for it. But in the end, you see that it was all tricks. As the great Zen master Rinzai said. Well, after all, there was nothing much in Obaku's Buddhism. And he went on to explain to his students that the art of Zen, or teaching Zen, is like deceiving a child with an empty fist. You know how you can intrigue a child by pretending you've got something very precious in your fist. And you can play a game for an hour, provoking the child to ever greater enthusiasm to find out what you've got. And in the end, the revelation is that there was nothing there. So many people say, in the course of their Zen training, I realized there was nothing to realize. It was all there from the beginning. Because you see, standing opposite to the realization that you can't do anything about it, and equivalently that you can't do nothing about it, comes, of course, the awakening that the reason for that is there is no you separate from you. In other words, when you try to control your thoughts or control your feelings, there is no difference between the thoughts and the controller. Because what you call the thinker is simply your thought of yourself. The thinker is a thought among thoughts, and the feeler is a feeling among feelings. And trying to control thoughts with thoughts is like trying to bite your own teeth. So you found that out. Well, then the other side of the picture is, of course, that if you do find that out, you discover that the project of controlling yourself was unnecessary, because you were yourself a Buddha from the very beginning. That's what the Upanishads mean when they say quite simply, tattvamasi, you're it. You, as you are. Now, how can you conceive that? Supposing you let your imagination go and really think through what you would like to happen. Imagine the most gorgeous state of bliss that you can conceive, where there are no worries, no anxiety, no haunting future with unpleasant consequences. You are in control of the whole works, and you are sitting on your lotus, perfectly content. And I ask you seriously, is that really what you want? Are you quite sure that's what you want? Imagine now, let's get this situation straight. You've got everything you want. You're in the highest possible spiritual state that you can conceive. And yet, I haven't really surrendered myself. Because I know it all. Something I don't know. So please, the surprise. You know what would happen? You would find yourself sitting here in this building tonight, feeling exactly the way you feel. There's your answer. Because after all, don't you have it all? Look, you have the feeling of yourself. But the feeling of self depends on there being at the same time a contrast, the feeling of other. The self has a certain sensation of being in control of life to some extent through voluntary action. The will seems to have a certain freedom. And yet, on the other hand, there are limits to that. And it seems in the end, life sweeps us away and we are overwhelmed by the involuntary. And yet, The voluntary keeps popping up. New voluntaries come into the world with every baby. So you see, you couldn't have the experience you call being a voluntarily acting self without the contrast of the involuntary happening. Now, do you want to be without the involuntary happening? You want to get rid of that? All right. If you get rid of it, you won't have the experience of the voluntary self. Or would you like to turn it the other way around? Would you like to have the experience of no voluntary self? And on the other hand, everything just happened. Well, then you say, well, I'm not sure about that. Because then I would feel at first that I was floating. See, that I had no further responsibilities. That I was just walking on air. And we do get that feeling sometimes. If you take the ideas of determinism and fatalism to their final conclusion, you do have that sense of freedom from all responsibility. Freedom from worry and care. And you float along for a while, but it wears off. You don't somehow seem to be able to follow out that philosophy consistently. Especially if you have children. And somehow a society begins to push on you to be responsible, as it pushes on children to be responsible. And so this nagging duality keeps coming back. That I cannot realize the nice irresponsible condition of involuntary behavior unless I have the contrast of the possibility of the voluntary, and vice versa. And what does that mean? Obviously, it means that these two aspects or sides of our experience, which we can call the voluntary and the involuntary, the knower and the known, the subject and the object, the self and the other, although appearing to be two, are indeed one. Because you can't have one without the other. And when that state of affairs arises, you know at once that there's a conspiracy. That two things which look as different can be are for that very reason the same. Now, you can detect even under those actions of yours which you call voluntary, the voluntary movement of the muscles or of the mind, that there are processes which are not voluntary. You do not will your blood to circulate. You do not control by intention the synapses in your nervous system. And yet you would be incapable of any voluntary action unless those involuntary processes were going on. So you see these two things go together. And you begin to realize something which is rather difficult to describe. That what you call your experience is a do happening. We don't have good words for this. We have some words which have this sort of sense, like the word cleave, which means to stick together or to hold together and also to split. And the word sucker in Latin means holy and accursed. And so I would like to propose we all should find some word for a do happening. Because it's all a do happening. That's what Buddhists mean when they talk about karma. The word karma means action. And when something happens to you, be it good or bad, they say it is your karma. That means, quite simply, it is your doing. But you say, I didn't mean to do that. No. One school of thought will explain it by saying, but you see, you did something in a former life, or at a former time, which now has this consequence. But that's a very superficial understanding of karma. You don't need to believe in reincarnation to understand karma. Karma is simply that you don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. That with one aspect, you are doing what you call the environment, and with the other aspect, you are doing what you call the organism, the me, this living body. But as you cannot conceive, possibly, the existence of a living body with no environment, that is the clue that the two are basically one. Like the two poles of a magnet, north is quite different from south, and yet it's all one magnet. So in precisely the same way, you are both what you do and what happens to you. So that you have a little game in which you play that what happens to you, that you're not responsible for. That's not you, see? You're only responsible for this side of it. And then you can compete with the other side. What it's like is this. Get two knitting pins, one in each hand, and have a fencing match with yourself. And really sincerely try to stick the other hand. But that other hand must really sincerely be trying to stick the first one and also to defend itself. It's like playing chess with yourself. You see? Now, it won't work. You'll come to a sort of standstill unless you decide for your right hand that that's the one that's really going to win. Well, then you've broken the rule of the game, you see? Well, that's what we do. That's what is called by both the Hindus and the Buddhists, avidya, ignorance, which really better means ignorance. So what it comes down to, you see, is basically this, just in the same way that the authority of the guru is your authority. You did it. So the place where you are in life is where you've put yourself. And just as on the surface of a sphere, every point may be regarded as the center of the surface, so every place may be regarded as the true place. And everyone's in his true place. Everybody, in other words, put it in what language you will, is a manifestation of the divine. Playing this game, that game, and the other game. And you're not knowing it, if you don't know it, is part of the game. Makes it all the more fun. Get lost, you say to yourself, and lost you get. Like children love to play hide and seek, to get lost. Like we all like to go to a play, see a horror movie, and have the cold shivers because we think the awful awfuls are going to happen. Something is going to be seen on the screen which we can't stand to see. Well, won't that be a thrill if it happens? We all expose ourselves to that, just as children. And young people are always exposing themselves to dreadful things. And the parents get absolutely, they get the heebie-jeebies. They think, if it isn't getting drunk or driving hot rods, they take drugs. And that may ruin their sanity for life. How horrible can it be? And if they don't take drugs, they'll do something else. Always to see how close to the point of danger you can get. And most people who go in for racing cars usually end up in a crash. And they know it. But the life is all the sweeter for being played dangerously. So I would say to those among you who are the most deadheads, in the sense of unspiritual and square, if there are any here, a real stuffy people, congratulations. You see? You're playing a very far out game. See, you're so lost you don't even know where you stand. That's taking a gorgeous risk. Why? Because of you, we might even blow up the planet. How close are we going to get to that one? Well, just in the same way as that car racer watches the needle going up, 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 there are these people feeling more and more and more righteous, determined that good shall prevail, watching that needle go up, it's getting hotter and hotter and hotter, and finally they go out in a blaze of glory. And then when the dust settles, they say, whew, that was a close squeak. I mean, that was quite a dream we've woken up from. See, where will we go next? See, here's, that's the point, simple. That's why I would say that my function is liberative. I want you to see that it's you. It's not me. It's not Swami so-and-so. It's not Buddha so-and-so. It's not Saint so-and-so. It's you. You do it. As Sir Edwin Arnold put the words into the mouth of the Buddha, you suffer from yourselves. None else compels. None other holds you that you live and die and whir upon the wheel and hug and kiss its spokes of agony, its tire of tears, its nape of nothingness. And when one of the old Zen masters went to his teacher and said, what is the way to liberation? Teacher said, who is restraining you? He said, no one. If so, why should you ask for liberation? It all bounces back to you. What do you want? Do you know what you want? Can you think it through? Say exactly what you want. And invariably, you'll get back to the place where you are. Because what you say you want is always the symptom, the expression of what you are now. If then that is the case, that it's all there because you're doing it, why meditate? Why do anything of a so-called spiritual nature? People don't understand really what meditation is. They take it up like they take up psychotherapy or a course in weight reduction in order to be better. But if you do that, you are not practicing what is called jhana or yoga or zen. That's not it at all. Meditation is the one human activity which has no purpose. Buddhas, who are supposed to have attained everything, are invariably shown in some sort of meditation posture. Why should they meditate anymore? Because that just happens to be the way that a Buddha sits when he sits. When he sits, he sits. When he walks, he walks. He's not going anywhere. He's just going for a walk. Because he digs it. See, to dig, the word, very word, means not merely to appreciate, but to penetrate. To go to the heart of the matter and to penetrate the moment. To get right to the root of the moment is nowhere else than the center of you, where you are. It's where you start this whole thing. I mean, to get with yourself is to get at the moment where you begin all this questioning. Where does the question come from? Where does the desire spring from? Well, that's you, and that you is the point from which the whole universe is created. Flowing back into the past like the wake of a ship. Wake doesn't drive the ship, it's the ship that makes the wake. So here you are, producing it. And meditation is just sitting and watching it happen. And it's not done because it's good for you. It's done for fun. I might even say meditation is a fun thing. And if it isn't, you're not meditating. There's an awful game that meditators play, which is competitive suffering. Now they go to some place where they sit for hours on end until their legs ache and practically fall off. And then come back and brag about they sat through all those hours of leg aching. Now, it's very difficult to put down people who are suffering. Because, after all, one has a natural sympathy for pain. But I sometimes want to say, for goodness sake, don't throw your suffering at me in that way and in that spirit. Don't brag about it. Don't one-up me by saying, well, I've suffered more than you have. People do things like that. They say, well, I'm more aware of my shortcomings than you are. I'm more tolerant than you are. I recognize more than you do what a rascal I am. Every kind of way of one-upping somebody else in order to play the game in which I always win. So once we get into that kind of thing with the meditation scene, we get into hierarchies and ranks and degrees and who has attained number 7, who has attained number 9, and the expert guru will always put a stage higher than anyone anybody's thought of. Just so as to see how far your ambition will run. And so this goes on endlessly, 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 until you suddenly wake up and begin real meditation by realizing that you were there. That you do really meditate all the time by virtue of existing all the time. Only you miss that eternal now by always looking for something next minute, expecting a result. Now you can say, let me not expect a result, because one does anyway. And so you may just as well sit and enjoy it.
It continues with Session 2, Mysticism and Morality.
When I use the word mysticism, I'm referring to a kind of experience, a kind of, state of consciousness, which seems to be as prevalent among human beings as measles. It's something that simply happens. And we don't know why it happens. And although there are all sorts of techniques which claim to be able to promote it, and which are more or less successful in doing so, and sometimes rather less than more, nevertheless, there is this peculiar thing that happens to people. And it's been recorded as far back in time as we have any recording at all. And that is coming over people the peculiarly convincing sensation that their ordinary sense of individuality, of personal identity, is transcended. And the individual suddenly feels an experience that actually it could be described from a number of quite different points of view. But we could add up these dominant characteristics. That instead of the ordinary feeling that I, as an individual, confront a world that is foreign to me, that is not me. In this kind of experience, I find myself to be of one and the same nature or identity as the world outside me. In other words, I suddenly feel no longer a stranger in the world, but as if the external world were my own body. The next aspect of the feeling is even more difficult to assimilate to our ordinary practical intelligence, but a very overwhelming feeling that everything that happens, everything I have ever done, everything anybody else has ever done, was part of our harmonious design. That there is no error at all. And that's the sort of thing I'm referring to. Now, you see, I'm not talking about a philosophy. I'm not talking about a rationalization, some sort of theory that somebody cooked up in order to explain the world and make it seem a tolerable place to live in. I'm talking about a rather whimsical, unpredictable experience that suddenly hits people. And it includes this element of feeling the total harmoniousness of everything. Now, I realize that those words can carry with them a sort of sentimental feeling, a sort of Pollyanna feeling. There are various religions in our society today which try to inculcate in you the belief that everything is a harmonious unity. You know, things like Christian Science or the Unity Movement and so on. They want to make a kind of propaganda for one to believe, and through believing to feel, that everything is harmonious. Now, to my mind, that is a kind of pseudo-mysticism, because it's an attempt to make the tail wag the dog. To make the effect produce the cause. Because this sensation of things being harmonious is somehow never brought about by insisting to yourself that that is so. Because when you do that, when you would say to yourself, all things are light, all things are God, all things are beautiful, etc. Actually, by doing that, you're implying that they're not. Because you wouldn't be saying all this stuff if you really knew it to be true. So, this thing, the sensation of a kind of universal harmony, cannot come to us when it is sought. When we look for it as something to be an escape from the way we actually feel, or to compensate for the way we actually feel. It's a thing that comes out of the blue. And when it comes out of the blue, just like hiccups come out of the blue, or something like that, it's overwhelmingly convincing. And it stands as, actually, the foundation for most of mankind's profound philosophical, mystical, metaphysical, and religious ideas. Someone, in other words, to whom this sort of thing has happened. And as I said before, it strikes us as measles may strike us. Someone to whom this sort of thing has happened can't restrain himself when it has happened, and he has to get up and tell everybody about it. And alas, he becomes the founder of a religion. Because people say, look at that man, how happy he is. What conviction he has. He has no doubts. He seems to be sure in everything he does. You see, that's a wonderful thing about a great human being. He's like an animal or a flower.
See, when a flower buds and the bud goes pop and opens, it has no hesitation or doubts about it. But when a young woman appears in society as a debutante, you know, she's not quite sure if she's going to come off. And she appears on the stage of society with some doubts in her mind. And therefore, all appearances of this kind are a rather sickly nature. But when the bird sings, or the chicken's egg breaks, or the flower buds, there's no doubt about it at all, it comes forth. And so in the same way, when somebody has an experience of this kind, he just has to tell everybody about it. Because you see, he sees everybody around him looking dreadfully serious. Looking as if they had a problem. Looking as if the act of living were extremely difficult. But from his standpoint, the person who's had this experience, he feels that they look funny, that they don't understand, that there isn't any problem at all. That he has seen from where he stands, you see, that the meaning of being alive is just being alive. That is to say, I look at the color of your hair and the shape of your eyebrow, and I understand that that is the point. That's what we're all here for. And it's so plain, and it's so obvious, and so simple. And yet here is everybody rushing around in a great panic, as if it were necessary for them to achieve something beyond all that. And the funny thing is, they're not quite sure what it is. But they are devilishly intent upon it, after that thing. And so, to the person in the state of consciousness, which I call mystical, that all seems very weird, very absurd. But it's not something that you criticize in an unkindly way. You don't say, those damn fools, those idiots. You say, it's such a pity that they don't see it. Because although they are going around in this wildly ignorant pursuit, one of the funny things about it is that they don't realize that there is a dimension, a sense in which their pursuit is magnificent. It's to give an obverse sense to the saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Turn that into its opposite. Not forgive them, but give them a blessing, because they don't know what they do. Give them an honor. In other words, the intensely serious preoccupations and anxieties of mankind appear from this standpoint. Not to be foolishness, but to be a kind of marvel. In the same way, perhaps, as you could say, that the protective coloring of a butterfly who has somehow contrived to make its wings look like enormous eyes, so that when a bird who is about to devour this beast is confronted by these staring eyes, the bird is a little hesitating, as when you stare at somebody, they're always taken a little bit aback. And so the butterfly appears to stare at the bird. And perhaps you see this phenomenon of the marvelous staring wings of the butterfly is in some way a result of anxiety, the anxiety to survive all the problems and struggles of natural selection. Nevertheless, in this intense struggle, we are unknowing poets. You see, one of the greatest ideas in the world that has ever been produced is, for my thinking, the Hindu idea that the world is a drama in which the central and supreme self behind all existence gets lost and involved. And pretends, plays, that he or it, or he, she, or whatever you want to call it, is all the creatures that there are, and gets totally involved. And thus, you see, the more involved, the more anxious, the more finite, the more limited the infinite manages to feel itself to be, the greater the artistry, the greater the depth of the illusion which is created. For you see, all art is in a way illusion. The art of the magician is the art of illusion, the art of misdirecting attention so that a magic seems to appear. And so, in this way, the more there is anxiety, the more there is uncertainty, to that degree the play has succeeded, in the same way as when you are watching an actual play or reading a novel or a movie, the more the author or the actors manage to grip you and to persuade you just for a moment that you are actually involved in reality, the more they have succeeded as artists. You may have a faint recognition in the back of your mind that this is, after all, only a play, when you sit on the edge of your seat and you're sweating and your hands clutch the arms of the chair, and the scene so grips you. That is magnificent acting. And so the Hindus feel that the whole arrangement of the cosmos is something exactly like that. That when in the reality of actual life you are sweating it out and you're wondering whether this surgeon who's got to operate on you in a matter of life and death is a competent man or a charlatan, or whether the investment that you made is a good thing or whether it's going to make you lose your shirt, you see, all those matters of terrific crisis are exactly the same as when you're sitting in the theatre sweating it out there. But now a far more convincing theatre has been arranged, because, as the Hindus would say, that in you which is it, the basis of you, the thing that is real in you and that connects you under the surface with every other being that is alive, this is the player of the parts, this is the maker of the illusion, this is the player of the game which has got you involved in this mess and is living it up in the same way as those actors on the stage are living it up to convince you that this is a real situation. And this is very understandable, because basically everybody loves to play this game. The game of hide and seek. The game of scaring oneself. Running up behind yourself in the dark and saying, boom! All children like to do this. And this is the most human thing. That's why we go to the play, to the movie, and why we read novels. And our so-called real life is, from the position of the mystic, an extension of the same thing. Because, you see, he is the person who suddenly has realized that the game is a game. You see, if the game is hide and seek, or if the game is lost and found, everything to do with the hide side, or the lost side, is connected with where we as individuals feel lonely, impotent, put down, and so on. All the negative side of existence. I have tried to show you at various times that there's really one simple principle that underlies everything, and it's so simple it's funny. The principle is, all insides have outsides. Because you see, you don't know that the inside is inside unless there's an outside, and you don't know that the outside is outside unless there's an inside. Okay, then you, as you ordinarily feel yourself, are the inside. You are the animate, sensitive being inside the skin. But the inside of the skin goes with the outside of the skin. If there weren't the outside of the skin, there wouldn't be no inside. And the outside of the skin is the whole darn cosmos. Galaxy beyond galaxy and everything, you see? And that goes with the outside, in the same way that front goes with back. So that if you wake up and understand that, you find that the two are one and the same identity, one and the same self, one and the same life. So that's the mystic's point of view. He finds that out. Now, if I may switch, what is morals? In the sense in which I am using the term morality, or morals, it's a set of rules analogous to the rules of language. Now, it's perfectly obvious, isn't it, that we can talk to each other in English only if there is mutual agreement among ourselves as to how to use the language. What words refer to what experiences, and what ways of stringing words together to be meaningful are to be used. And it's very much of interest that we don't have too much trouble in coming to this agreement about language. We don't find that the police have to enforce grammar. The school teacher, yes. For little children, the school teacher does sometimes have to enforce grammar and say in an authoritative way, and in the old-fashioned schools with the aid of some implement of corporal punishment, that, you use the correct grammatical forms. But when we grow up into adult life, we use these grammatical forms without much difficulty. And very rarely do the police have to enforce it. But it is otherwise with other arrangements that we have to make in common. Because just as we have to agree in order to communicate about language, we have to agree about, say, the rules of driving on the highway, the rules of doing business, the rules of doing banking, and so on and so on, the rules of family arrangements and whatnot. And these are actually rules of the same kind as the rules of grammar. But alas, this is not very often recognized, because the authority, the sanctions, the power behind these rules is different from the authority behind grammar. What I mean is this. If you transgress the rules of grammar, people will shrug their shoulders and say, well, he doesn't make sense. They won't summon the police. But if you transgress the rules of driving on the highway, or the rules of finances, someone is likely to summon the police. And so one sees the authority of the state as standing behind those rules. And there are other rules where our society sees standing behind them not the authority of the state, but the authority of the Lord God Almighty. So that if you transgress those rules, you're in danger not simply of going to jail, but, according to your religious persuasion, of frying forever in hell, or, on the other hand, of failing lamentably to be a real person. Now, the problem is this. Where the domain of mysticism and the domain of morals come into conflict. You see, throughout the all known history of religion, the mystics have been suspect. Insofar as religions have been the upholders of moral rules, the, as it were, the guardians, the authorities, in the same way, for example, as the lexicographers or the grammarians guard the rules of grammar and expound upon them, so in the same way the priesthoods and the lawyers guard the rules of social behavior. But when into the domain of religion there appears the mystical experience, then the priests are very, very disturbed. Now, you all know that in recent months in California, there has been a very strange outbreak in the most respectable of all churches, the Episcopal Church. Various congregations of the Episcopal Church have had a phenomenon called glossolalia, and this means speaking with tongues. If you will turn on your radio to any Negro revival meeting on a Sunday night, you will hear glossolalia. That is to say, when the preacher starts talking sensibly, but the congregation gets more and more enthusiastic and says, "I hear you. Amen. Yes, Lord." And so on. And it works up the preacher so that by the time he's through, he's not talking sense anymore. He's just lolling. He's going through glorious nonsense. In other words, he's become all the dry theological categories have turned into not only poetry, but beyond poetry, into music. And he's just saying, you see, he's just going like that. And the congregation's behind him, and it's wonderful. You see, he's become at that moment one in spirit with the universe, because that's what the stars are doing. The stars above us, the galaxies, they're not making sense. See? They're making a colossal display of fireworks in the sky. See? It's going like that. Well, it so happened that in recent months, various congregations of the Episcopal Church had outbreaks of this. The Bishop of California, when all this happened, Bishop Pike, wrote an encyclical letter to his pastors and said, "With all due regard for everything, you know, we must not be too dogmatic. We must recognize always that the Spirit of God may work in mysterious ways that cannot be foreseen. And we should keep an open mind about all these matters." This was said in a very complicated way for several pages. But then finally, when it came to speaking with tongues, in effect, this must not happen in the Episcopal Church. Yeah, I mean, in effect, this was what was said. It was said, you know, the iron hand was in a velvet glove. But this mustn't happen. Now,